Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Will Schwalbe, author of The End of Your Life Book Club, and photographer David Spielman, whose new book is When Not Performing, New Orleans Musicians. Will Schwalbe is a man about books. He's been a publishing executive, the senior vice president and editor-in-chief of Hyperion Books. He started a wonderful website called Cookster, based on his love of food. He's already been a best-selling author with the book he wrote with his friend David Shipley, called Send, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better. And he's about to be a best-selling author again with what is absolutely my favorite book I've read this year, The End of Your Life Book Club. Will, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Your very intimate book club of two, you and your mother, Marianne Schwalbe, began during a time of great stress, didn't it?
It really did. It was a very stressful time, and we found ourselves turning again and again to books as something to talk about, something to relieve the stress, and as a way of talking about what we were going through. Mom had just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, stage 4, which means it has already spread to other organs.
And you, as you accompanied her to chemo, the book club evolved, didn't it?
Exactly. All my life I had talked with my mother about books. So that was something that we had always done. But I found myself spending more and more time with her, as did my father and my siblings and friends, as we all accompanied her to various different kinds of appointments. And I usually went with her to chemo. And it was actually the first time I went with her that we realized that in the weeks since her diagnosis, we've been talking more and more and more about books. And I kind of joked that if we kept spending all this time together and kept talking so much about books, it would be kind of like a book club. And she laughed and said, "Doesn't a book club need food?" And I said, "Well, we'll be a foodless book club." And that's how it all got started.
Well, it still turned out pretty well, even without food.
It did. We always had something to talk about, and we had extraordinary, extraordinary conversations. And it turned out to be such a special time for me, and I got to know my mother so much better and in such a different way than I ever had. And pancreatic cancer very often takes people in 3 to 6 months, but Mom had 2 years. And over the course of those 2 years, we had extraordinary conversations.
And then this book grew out of a blog you started, right?
Well, one of the things that I did was I created a blog, and a lot of people do this kind of thing when a family member is ill, in order to keep all the friends and family up to date on what was going on. Mom was a little hesitant about a blog, and she certainly didn't want to write it. But in fact, she wound up writing the posts for me in my voice. She would wind up saying, "Well, why don't you say something like this?" And she would write it as though I had written about her, and then I would post it. So I had the blog going, and we had these wonderful conversations about books. And then it actually was really a couple months before she died that I turned to her and I said, "You know, I think I'd really like to write something about the conversations we've had, about the book club, about the books we've read." And her reaction was, "Well, you know, why would you want to do that? You have so much else to do. You have so many other things to write about." And yet, the next day, she sent me an email, and there in the email was a list of all the books that we had read, and that we never talked about the book I would write about her again. She followed up with many more emails saying, "Don't forget to include this, and don't forget to include that."
Well, I love it that all these books are listed so people can go back and choose them and read them for themselves. Tell us some of your favorites, some of the ones that meant the most to you.
Well, one of the books that got us started was Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. And this is a masterpiece. It's about the lifelong friendship of two couples. And anyone who hasn't read it should run to their favorite bookstore and buy a copy. We loved Gilead by Marilyn Robinson, but we also read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo by Stieg Larsson. We read P.G. Woodhouse. We read a terrific book by Sheila Weller called Girls Like Us, about Carole King and Joni Mitchell, and we read so many different things. We read Geraldine Brooks, People of the Book. We read really the way real people do. We hopped from one thing to another. We read Jhumpa Lahiri. Whenever we heard about a terrific book, we read it.
One of the interesting developments about all this is, because I know you read sometimes on an e-reader, but your mother, I think, preferred books. And I've heard you say that one of the things that came to you was this renewed appreciation for the physical book.
It really did. I still read a lot of books on an e-reader. I really like my e-reader. It was not for Mom. She was not an e-reader person. But one of the things that really moved me over the course of this was to see how much comfort Mom took in the physical book and to see how much she loved holding her favorite books and flipping through them. And in fact, I write about when she was literally dying in home hospice in the last couple days, and she was lying in bed and I was sitting with her, I was able to see that she could see in her final days a bookshelf. And on that bookshelf, she had all her favorite books. And that these books really were her teachers and her guides. And it gave her enormous comfort to look at that bookshelf and see all these wonderful books. And I did come away with a really renewed appreciation for the physical book. And I still read things on my e-reader, but I also, when there's a book I love, I have to buy a physical copy of it. And I still love physical books, too. So it is a remarkable thing to hold in your hand a book that you love, to flip the pages. And I had somewhat forgotten how special that was, and that's just one of the many things that Mom helped me remember.
And there was one special book she carried about, like a talisman, this little book called Daily Strength for Daily Needs.
Yes, she had this remarkable little book. My mother was a very devout Christian, and I'm way more into the agnostic territory, and we talked about faith quite a lot. And one of the books that was most important to Mom was this little book, Daily Strength for Daily Needs. It had a separate page for each day of the year. And the page had religious quotes on it, quotes from the Bible, but also general inspirational quotes. And actually, Mom's secondhand copy was printed the very year she was born. It had clearly been owned by lots of other people. It was foxed and frayed and had lost its jacket if it ever had one. And Mom took a lot of comfort, I think, from the fact that that little book had not only comforted her over the time she had it, but had comforted many people before her. And she carried it with her everywhere. It was in her purse when we went to the hospital. It was next to her at chemo, and it was on her bed when she died.
I loved it that she seemed sometimes to leave it out just for you to look at sometimes, too.
She had at home a little staging area, the coffee table, and she would leave things there that family members were supposed to see and look at. And she would, on certain days when there was a quote that she thought would be especially meaningful for me, would leave it with this wonderful bookmark that she had from a refugee camp she'd visited right on the coffee table. And it was very clear I was supposed to read that day's entry when she went to do something.
And I love the image of you two in bookstores together, the kinds of serendipities you describe that happened to both of you.
We had so much fun going to bookstores together. I love going to great independent bookstores, and so did my mother. And we had different systems for choosing what book we would read. One was alphabetical, so you would go to one part of the store and you'd see one author's name, but you'd always look left and right to see what authors you'd always intended to read had alphabet letters that came before or alphabet letters that came after. And I have one big superstition in bookstores, which is if I knock over a book by accident, it means destiny is telling me I must read that book. So I always buy any book that I accidentally knock over. And that's actually how we wound up reading The Collected Short Stories, Volume 2 by Somerset Maugham, because I knocked it over in the Vero Beach Book Center in Vero Beach, Florida.
And tell us about her passion for libraries. That was another thing that moved me very much about her.
When I was growing up, she was a college admissions director, and then she became an educator at the high school level. And in her 50s, she discovered the cause of refugees. And she became founding director of something now called the Women's Refugee Commission and traveled all over the world to refugee camps in really the direst parts of the world, in Liberia, in Burma. And everywhere she went, she would ask refugees what they needed most. And of course, there was health care, but there was always books. They always said they needed books. And with books, there was hope. And without books, there was no hope. So one of her passions became libraries and books and the idea of making books available to people all over the world. And she'd actually traveled many times to Afghanistan and met an extraordinary woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree, whose dream it was to build a national library, research center, cultural center in Kabul to house this incredible collection of 38,000 books she and her husband had. So my mother determined that she wanted to do one more big thing before she died, and that was help Nancy Hatch Dupree build this library in Kabul, and also traveling libraries to go to every village across Afghanistan.
And that, I think, was one of the biggest things anybody could want to do, you know?
Yeah. One of the things she felt so strongly about books is that books tell you what you need to do in life. And she had loved Khaled Hosseini's The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns. Even though she was involved with Afghanistan long before she read those books, but she felt anyone who read those books and moved had to want to do something to help in Afghanistan. And books, what a concrete way to help, to get people books, and with books come hope.
Well, I was so moved by this book. I recently had to write a remembrance of a friend who had passed away, and I realized as I did that our conversations about books were some of the most important conversations I'd ever had in my life. And you found that with your mother.
I really did. I had such a remarkable time those last 2 years having conversations about books with her, but I also realized I'd had a lifetime of wonderful conversations about books with my mother. And one of the things that I really hope that this book accomplishes is to remind people how special it is to share a book with someone that you love. And I've already had one reaction to the book that I think moved me more than any other reaction that I could ever possibly get, which is someone telling me, "Will, I finished the last page of your book, I put it down, I picked up the phone, I called my mother, and I said, what are you reading?"
Perfect. You couldn't ask for anything better.
No. And it gives people something in common. And it also, as my mother and I learned, it gives you something to talk about when you don't want to talk about yourself. But it also gives you a way to talk about yourself that nothing else gives you.
And it's a way to share all the big things in life, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a way to engage with life's biggest questions because great books help you do that. And I loved talking about so many of the great books we read together. And one of the fun things about publishing a book like this, and I know it's odd to use a word fun when you're talking about a book like this, but it really is a fun thing, is I get to talk to people all over the country, all over the world about the books they love, and that's just a treat.
Well, it's certainly a book that's filled with joy, that kind of deep, deep joy. Thank you for sharing this with us. It's an inspiration. I thank you for this book from the bottom of my heart. You can meet Will Schwalbe at Garden District Bookshop November 15th at 5:30. Will, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on and for your wonderful words. Thank you.
David Spielman has created two of my favorite books, a collection of portraits, Southern Writers, and then the Katrinaville Chronicles, a record of his time during and after Hurricane Katrina, caring for the uptown monastery of the Poor Clares. Now he's here to talk about a new book, When Not Performing, his portraits of New Orleans musicians. David did the photography for the book, and his collaborator, Fred Lyon, composed the text. Welcome to The Reading Life, David.
Well, thanks very much. I'm blushing. I've never had such a nice introduction. Thank you, Susan.
This book is a treasure trove of New Orleans musicians, and it took you a long time to work up to doing it. Tell us about some of the decisions you made up front that led to this.
Well, I moved to New Orleans 40 years ago. And that first year in 1973, I went out to the Jazz Fest, and I was introduced to Michael Smith. And it became apparent very quickly thereafter that he owned the photography of taking pictures of musicians on stage. So I went about becoming a photographer here, building a name, but always in the back of my mind, I wanted to do pictures of musicians, but I had to find my voice. Early in the 50s, a fellow by the name of Ralston Crawford did a series of pictures of musicians in the juke joints and in the clubs. In the 50s, he had to get a permit from the police for a white man to go into these clubs. And then, of course, Lee Friedlander did a wonderful book starting. He came here first in 57 and then through the 60s. And he did a lot of the pictures of the musicians at home, but it was while they were being interviewed by the Tulane Jazz Archive. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then there's Mike Smith. And so these three books were very, very important to me. And so I had to figure out how I was going to find something visually different. And so it just dawned on me that another picture of them on stage performing wasn't very exciting. I wanted, as I did with Southern Riders, get into their personal life, get into their personalities and their life. That's how it started.
So were most of your subjects receptive to the idea? Were any of them elusive or?
Well, musicians, by the nature of the business, are not the most organized individuals. There were plenty of times when appointments were set, places decided, and they forgot. It's a little bit like herding cats. But once it was rescheduled, once we hooked up, and once we started taking the pictures, it was magical. Some of them would be sort of reluctant, thinking, I want to be paid for this. And when I explained that that isn't the way this happens, I also pointed out that after the book comes out and somebody sees and reads about them, goes to one of their performances, buys one of their CDs, are they going to send me a royalty check? Of course not. So all in all, everybody was very receptive. And many of them were thrilled because they thought it was a very fresh approach.
And one of the magical things about this book as you're going through it is that you realize how many musical families we have here. And that really comes through in these pages. And you actually have one family portrait that's so endearing.
Right. The Mazikowski, Steve Mazikowski, his wife and their daughter, Sasha. You know, you're confronted with this all the time. The book is done alphabetically. And so you get to the Marcelluses and you'll see a bunch of them, or you'll see, you know, the James Andrews and his mm-hmm. cousins and things like that. And then, of course, as you're talking to them, you realize that they're a cousin of, or a, you know, nephew of all of these people that came before them. So it is a wonderful connection of people and personalities and families.
And I love the way the elders emphasize the young people's contributions. It's like Steve saying, well, everybody always asks me if I'm Sasha's father, but no one ever asked her. And Donald Harrison getting his nephew, Christian Scott, to come along. That's a real magical connection.
Well, it is. And, you know, the important thing, I think, is that music is passed by generations. These little kids, these children, are exposed to it running around the house. I mean, Ben Jaffe, for example, played at Preservation Hall when his parents had started it. So he's at the feet of these masters. How could that not influence him? Mm-hmm. And so music is one of our greatest attractions. And it's certainly one of our greatest exports. And I tried with this book, I want it to be a window into the musical community. And these are a bunch of puzzle pieces. I want the reader, after they buy the book, to look at it and then go find their own pieces to the musical puzzle of New Orleans, because it's never ending.
Oh, I know. And it's always adapting slightly as time passes. I loved it when Ben Jaffe said in his comments that he felt he was protecting the legacy of Preservation Hall, not necessarily preserving, that whole notion of the difference. Oh, and it was a lovely distinction, I thought.
It is. It's huge. And you hear it from the other people. I mean, you know, you look at Donald Harrison Jr. He teaches a summer school jazz class at Newman School. He knows that he has a responsibility to infuse it into the next generation. Mm-hmm. And he does it very unselfishly and very, very nicely.
And you very generously included a couple of people who are stalwarts in the musical community who are not musicians.
Here again, music encompasses all of us. Quint Davis, I mean, he's the godfather of music because of the Jazz Fest. A guy named Barry Smith, who has this wonderful music store, I mean, this record shop down in the French Quarter. they are the promoters. They are the guardians of the flame, so to speak. I've got 501 Dancing Man in there.
Yes, 504.
Or 504, excuse me, 504. This is a kid that goes to where the brass bands play, dances for tips, and he makes a living.
And he teaches. That's what I love that. He passes it on.
It was one of those remarkable adventures that this thing just keeps opening up. And especially the first photograph in the book is the unknown musician.
I love that so much.
Well, thank you. Fred and I had gone over to take pictures of Frogman Henry. So we're driving around on the West Bank. Of course, we're early because that's my nature. All of a sudden, we hear this music kind of wafting through the neighborhood. And so we both simultaneously, our ears perk up and we roll our windows down. And so we start trying to triangulate and find out where it's coming from. And of course, we're having this discussion of, did the kid's mother throw him out of the house because he's making too much noise? Did it wake the baby? Were the neighbors complaining? And so all of a sudden, we figure out where this noise is coming from, and it's up on top of the levee. And this young man is up there blowing his horn. He's got a towel over his head, and he's facing the river. He has to play that music. So we listen, we talk about it, how it really represents New Orleans and the importance of music. Get out of the car, introduce ourselves, ask permission to take his picture, but I did not want to see his face. I wanted him on this brutally hot summer day with a towel over his head with his horn exposed playing. And it really, I think, represents the music and the importance of music to the city and the area of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Some of those most magical musical moments come anonymously like that. I remember once I was driving down Nashville Avenue and I had my windows down and I was playing an Irvin Mayfield CD. And this kid was walking up the other way. And so I drove past and there was this particularly lovely little moment and he played back.
Yeah.
I'll never know who that was, but it made it all the more special in so many ways.
Well, one of the things that has always impacted me is when you'll be riding down the street and you'll see some kids with drumsticks beating on the trash cans, or you'll see guys blowing their horns, or they'll be rapping, waiting for a bus. And so music is such an important everyday part of the life of New Orleans. And I tell people that I love going down to the French Quarter around 6 o'clock because you see all of these men and women in tuxedos carrying their musical instruments. They're going to work. And one of the things that you learn from this book is that these musicians, it's hard work. Some of them play 2 and 3 different gigs a night.
Oh, yeah.
And they're compelled to do this. It is not an easy life. They're giving private lessons. They're teaching. They're doing whatever they can so that they can continue to play these gigs, looking for a better song, a perfect evening, and being unable to leave the music out of their life.
Now, I have to bring this up, although it is quite sad. Some of the musicians you photographed are no longer with us. And that must be really hard for you to have this book come out and they're not here to see it.
It is. It's one of the realities of doing something like this. I mean, you know, Coco Robichaud, who knew? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was outside of an apple barrel and boom, he was gone. Uncle Lionel, you know, he was up in age. He hadn't been well, but you still don't expect it. And of course, I didn't go to the wake because I knew that it was going to be chaotic. I had my picture, but who knew? They were going to have him stuffed standing up.
I know.
I mean, that's got to be the topic of the Morticians Convention someplace this year.
Oh, I'm sure. Now, do you have a favorite moment? Can you pick one out or were there too many?
There are way too many. People would say, well, who was your most favorite? And it's literally the last person I took the picture of because each one is unique and offers something. And one of the real advantages of what I get to do is I get to learn from all of these people. Everyone gave me a takeaway, some little thing. I mean, there's some pictures. I mean, my friend John Barrett, the guy that wrote in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, saw Dr. John's picture and he says, it's not very often you see Dr. John looking like an English country squire. So everybody was so generous. You know, as you know, I'm not from New Orleans. I'm from Oklahoma. So for this Okie to be able to hang out with these guys and take pictures of them is a real honor for me.
Well, you honored them. You did. You can meet David Spielman when he signs When Not Performing, New Orleans Musicians, Tuesday, November 13th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks so much, David.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guests, David Spielman and co-author Fred Lyon, sign When Not Performing, New Orleans Musicians, Tuesday, November 13th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. B.A. Shapiro signs The Art Forger, Wednesday, November 14th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Michael Allen Zell reads from and signs Errata, Wednesday, November 14th at 7 p.m. at Crew de Brew, sponsored by the New Orleans Lyceum. Today's guest, Will Schwalbe, signs The End of Your Life Book Club, Thursday, November 15th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Poppy Tooker, host of Louisiana Eats, signs Madame Begay's Recipes of Old New Orleans Creole Cookery, Thursday, November 15th at 1 p.m. at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Suzanne Johnson signs her latest urban fantasy novel, River Road, Thursday, November 15th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in Bayou St. John. Poets Claire Martin, Deborah Poe, and Matvey Yankelevich read from their work as part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, November 15th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Kit Wool signs New Orleans Classic Cocktails, Friday, November 16th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. Deb Shriver signs In the Spirit of New Orleans, Saturday, November 17th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop, and again Monday, November 19th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans meets Saturday, November 17th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. This week, they'll be discussing Great Expectations, Part 2, Chapters 15 through 19. Shelby Tucker signs his novel, Client Service, Tuesday, November 20th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. And remember, the big event this weekend is the New Orleans Book Fair and Media Expo, Saturday, November 17th at 725 Magazine Street. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, is the biggest event this month, starting November 28th and running through Sunday, December 2nd. Featured guests include the great Ernest Gaines, who will be honored by a special work composed by Irvin Mayfield and performed by the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra. Writers on the program include Pulitzer winners Oscar Higuelos and Jonathan Yardley, and writers Justin Torres, Maria Rana, playwrights John Biganay and Rosary O'Neill, Peggy Sweeney McDonald, Lawrence Powell, Moira Crone, and Roger Kamenetz, Freddie Evans, Ben Sandmel, Tom Barisco, Nancy Dixon, John Shelton Reed, Michael Allen Zell, Jeff Weiss, David Armand, Rich Cohen, Randy Fertel, Roy Blunt Jr., Andrew Lamb, George Bishop, Pamela Binning-Shewin, Hal Clark, Josephine Sacabo, and Dot Wonk, Carol DeSanti, Lori Carlson, Lisa Zeidner, Adam Johnson, and Lucy Ferris. Oh, and Peter Cooley and Brad Richard. For a complete schedule and tickets, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.